Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoi, and this is The Exchange. Franklin Roosevelt's first vice president, John Nance Gardner, famously observed that the vice presidency is not worth a bucket of warm spit. Yet 8 times in our history, vice presidents have suddenly ascended to the highest office in the land following the death of a president. Whether it was Andrew Johnson in the wake of Abraham Lincoln's assassination or Harry Truman after FDR's death in office, accidental presidents have left a powerful legacy on America's political landscape. In a new book, author Jared Cohen assesses why some triumphantly met the challenge while others have failed miserably. Today on The Exchange, Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America. And we'd like to hear from you. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And joining me this morning from New York City is Jared Cohen, author of Accidental Presidents. He's the founder and CEO of Jigsaw, a technology incubator and subsidiary of Alphabet Inc., the parent company of Google. He's also an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. And Jared, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Your background, let's talk a little bit about your background. It's not the typical path necessarily for somebody writing a history of American vice presidents. I note that you worked on the Secretary of State's planning policy staff for both Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton. And I read in a recent interview that you referred to Condoleezza Rice as a mentor of sorts. Can you say a little bit about your early work in the State Department?
Yes, of course. I joined the State Department when I was 23 years old, and I was there until I was 27 years old. So some people talk about being raised by wolves. I was raised by the State Department. And when I was there, I focused mostly on Middle East and counterterrorism and bringing technology into how we did foreign policy. But my real childhood love is history and presidents.
Mm-hmm. And I recall that you were also an early proponent of social media and foreign policy. There was the famous example of the resistance in Iran and the use of social media as a communication tool. Is that something you were involved in at the State Department?
Yes. When I joined as an advisor to Secretary Rice in 2006, there wasn't much of a relationship between technology and foreign policy. But I had lived in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, between 2004 and 2006. And I was always struck by the way that technology was being used by populations in these countries to challenge and subvert the regimes. So when I joined the State Department, I wanted to find a way to bring what I had seen firsthand with technology into how we practice some of our statecraft.
Mm-hmm. And how has this carried over into your current work at Jigsaw?
Look, the nexus between technology and geopolitics is far more pronounced today than it was back when I was in the State Department. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in the State Department, we had the Green Revolution in Iran, where I called up Jack Dorsey from Twitter to get them to delay their schedule maintenance so that Iranians could keep tweeting. But you had only a handful of those such examples. Now, technology is part of the day-to-day story of geopolitics and foreign policy. You have as much discussion around cybersecurity and cyber war as you do actual war and actual security.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I should mention that this is your fourth book. As a political scientist, I can tell you there aren't a lot of books about groups of vice presidents. We typically take note of them when they actually come out. Now, you mentioned you have had a love for the presidency and presidential politics for many years. But how did you come up with the idea for the book specifically? When did this start percolating for you as something you might do down the road a bit?
Well, for me, the original moment, I can pinpoint the exact moment when I was 8 years old and my parents bought me a book called The Buck Stops Here. It's one of those rhyming books about presidents. And they thought it was a great opportunity to saturate my mind with presidential history and that I would get a kick out of it. And they'd make me curious. And as they're reading the book, I'll never forget my parents look like a deer in headlights as eight times they had to have a conversation about death. And four of those times they had a conversation with me about assassination and murder. And you realize that at the time, the story of the presidency is a dark story when talking to an eight-year-old. And I tested this on my two kids. I have the same book and I refuse to read it to them because they have the same line of questioning. You know, yeah. Daddy, what does it mean to be shot to death? Well, okay, yeah. I'm not going to read this book to you.
Wow. Well, that's really interesting. And so, so more recently, people might say, you know, you're the CEO of a technology incubator. You've got Google, we got Alphabet. You're really busy. How did you, I'm curious, how did you find time to actually write this book?
Well, what I find about childhood interests is they sustain over very long periods of time. And, childhood Absolutely. Interests come and go depending on your bandwidth. And you know, I look at the current political climate right now, and it combines all three topics that my entire life I've been fascinated with: history, politics, and just general musings about what makes good and bad leadership. Mm-hmm. And so the catalyst for this, you know, I've been collecting presidential memorabilia my entire life. So I have signed presidential documents, paintings by presidents, locks of presidential okay. hair, which is weird until you see it, and a number of other things. And when my wife was pregnant with our now almost five-year-old, everybody needs a nesting activity. So my nesting activity was I went and I bought even more biographies about the accidental presidents. And I said, you know what, I'm gonna finally write this book because if I don't write it, I'm going to start annoying everybody.
Well, I read about your presidential memorabilia collection. It sounds wonderful. I'm a big collector as well, although probably not at the level that I read about you. But so what are your couple of favorite pieces that you have?
I have a lock of Abraham Lincoln's hair from the night of his assassination. I have a signed George Washington document, a discharge paper for a 22-year-old Pfeiffer from when he was the general of the Continental Army. Wow. And then I have a painting that was painted by Dwight Eisenhower during his second term as president. Wow. And when you're an amateur artist, you paint your own features.
Yep.
So whenever anybody sees my Eisenhower painting, they always say, wow, is that his son or is it a self-portrait? It's his chief of staff's son. And if you cover his hair and make him bald, it looks like Eisenhower. So we call it the baby Eisenhower.
That's great. I also read, do you have a Ronald Reagan mug that you use as an actual mug or just a remembrance mug?
I have a mug that Ronald Reagan used to drink out of while he was president. And so when I invite people over who love history, I make them drink from the Ronald Reagan mug.
That's a great story. So you found time to write this book amidst all your other activities. Let's dig into the book. I should say we're talking with Jared Cohen. He is the founder and chief executive officer of Jigsaw at Alphabet Inc. That's the parent company of Google. He's the author of a new book, Accidental Presidents, and the book I believe is out tomorrow. So this is very timely. And let's dig into the book now. And I'd like to begin a discussion talking a bit about a surprisingly confusing topic, and that's presidential succession. And you mentioned a variety of acts that were signed, I think, in 1792 and 1886 and 1947. And we have the 25th Amendment after JFK. But to me, the book made clear that there was for many years a tremendous amount of uncertainty going all the way back to the first accidental president, Tyler. Lots of discussion about acting versus actual and the role of the Senate pro tem. So say a little bit about some of the confusion. I mean, it really seems like they were kind of winging it back in the 19th century to some extent.
That's absolutely right. When you look at the story of presidential succession in America, I think we can let the founding fathers off the hook for not having thought through this in such intimate detail down to, you know, designated survivors and so forth. But in many respects, when writing this book, what I realize is that there's no excuse for not figuring this out and having it take eight presidents dying in office and 19 close calls to really be precise about what happens when the president dies in office. And it's true, we basically winged presidential succession. So there's two ways to look at this. You can look at it as completely reckless and careless, or you can look at it as, you know, maybe the Constitution is more flexible and a useful guide as a living document. But when William Henry Harrison dies in office in 1841, just 30 days after taking the presidential oath, John Tyler, who's the vice president, who was thrown on the ticket to win Virginia, which they lost, and to give a nod to states' rights, which didn't really happen either, it created America's first really significant constitutional crisis, because the Constitution was clear that the vice president discharges the duties of the president of the United States, but there was real debate about whether the vice president became the president of the United States. So there was a massive debate that ensued in Congress, and the cabinet, which he had inherited from William Henry Harrison, wanted Tyler to be vice president acting as president. He basically put the kibosh on that right away. And it took a resolution in Congress called the Wise Amendment, which formalized, at least as a precedent, that Tyler was the president of the United States. But that precedent wasn't official. It wasn't backed by a constitutional amendment. And John Tyler, for the rest of his career, would return any envelope unopened that listed him as vice president or acting president.
Yeah. And I'm curious if you have a sense of whether the founders left the succession intentionally vague. You know, there's historians often talk about how Article 2 of the Constitution, which establishes the presidency, is kind of short and vague in comparison to Article 1, which establishes Congress and has all the enumerated powers. Do you think this was an oversight, or you just think they figured people would figure it out through precedent down the road?
Well, remember, the founding fathers didn't really want a vice president. Eventually, it was an afterthought that was used more as an electoral mechanism than anything else. What's interesting is, I think what I find interesting is that the founding fathers, survived for a period of time after the Constitution, and you had a couple of close calls. James Madison nearly died of illness while president. And Dolly Madison wrote a letter to Congress saying he had made a speedy recovery a week before he actually did, because they had begun proceedings on the Senate floor for succession. Andrew Jackson was shot at point blank in the gun malfunction before he beat the assassin with his cane. So you had these two instances while there were still founding fathers alive where somebody could have asked them to interpret what they meant by this succession clause. And by the time William Henry Harrison dies and this debate ensues, the last living connection to the founding fathers is Dolly Madison, and she wasn't around to be part of those proceedings.
I think the other thing listeners might find a little surprising, and listeners, you can join in the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter. You can email exchange@nhpr.org, and I'll get it right here in the studio. And I think one thing that listeners might find surprising in the 19th century certainly was how frequently these accidental presidents went without any vice president at all. I think if that were to happen now, if a sitting president were to not have a vice president, there'd be tremendous consternation.
That's right. One of the things I found in writing The Accidental Presidents is that until the 25th Amendment, there's no mechanism for replacing the vice president. Mm-hmm. So when I was initially writing the book, I kept finding myself analyzing that the vice president who ascended to the presidency was reckless in not filling the vacancy. Yeah. And then I realized that they had no legal authority to do that. What's shocking about this is how many accidental presidents themselves nearly died in office. So John Tyler, who's the nation's first accidental president, nearly dies in a ship explosion on board the USS Princeton on February 28, 1844. The explosion kills several members of his cabinet. It's the greatest loss of life among senior officials in the history of the United States. It would have killed John Tyler had he not been downstairs flirting with a young woman who would eventually become
Julia
the First
Tyler,
Lady.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you had Andrew Johnson, who ascended to the presidency, who was basically on his deathbed in the first 6 weeks after ascending to the presidency, so much so that at the time the president pro tem, who was next in line of succession, was out west looking at treatment of Native Americans out in the western frontier, was sent a telegram saying he needed to rush back to Washington. Yeah. Teddy Roosevelt, when he ascended, was his carriage a year after he became vice president, a trolley crashed into it and it flung him nearly 30 feet, and he landed face down and had to get very life-threatening surgery.
Yeah, and I recall, I think in an interview you noted that people today would be surprised because we're in this long period where we haven't had any accidental presidents, really going back to JFK, that it was not unusual to have somebody die in office or something happen every 10 or 20 years, really.
That's correct. When Lyndon Johnson gave up the most powerful position in Congress to take the vice presidency, there was a more than 20% chance that he would ascend to that office. He actually did the math as part of his calculation. And before that, I mean, if you look at the 19 close calls plus the 8 presidents who died in office, if all of those close calls had resulted in death, it would have been 40% chances.
Yeah,
so the presidency itself is much more fragile than we realize historically. And that fragility is obfuscated by the fact that we are in the longest period of time in history without a president dying in office. The previous longest time was George Washington to William Henry Harrison. But before that, it was literally in every 10 to 20 year occurrence. And what I find amazing in writing the Accidental Presidents, I got really interested in just also the history of presidential protection. It took 3 presidents being assassinated, Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, and William McKinley, for somebody to decide that it was a good idea to have the Secret Service do more than counterfeiting and start protecting the president during peacetime.
Yeah, I think it's certainly the case today that the Secret Service presence, which is significant, obviously, and literally changes in healthcare, modern medicine, et cetera, has significantly reduced these probabilities. But it was fascinating to me in reading about some of these 19th century presidents, and I think maybe even Truman, I can't recall now. But I kept waiting, thinking to myself, okay, where's the vice president? And then I find out, well, there was no vice president for like a year or two.
Yeah, that's correct. The first vice presidential vacancy to be filled was after the 25th Amendment, when Richard Nixon resigns and he plucks Gerald Ford from Michigan's 5th.
Yeah.
That was the first time that there was a legal authority to replace the vice president, and it was exercised.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk a little bit now about the idea of the presidential ticket as a marriage of convenience. We often hear about the need for ticket balancing. Can you talk a little bit about how this worked, and I guess to some extent even today, but a little bit about what you mean by ticket balancing or marriage of convenience?
Well, if we look at how vice presidents are thrown on the ticket in modern times, it's the campaign that is deciding it, right? And they're often against the ropes. They're looking for a bump in the polls. It's very short term in their thinking. So they need to win a state. They need to appease a constituency. They need to unite the party. But it's very tactical from an electoral perspective. Mm-hmm. And look, sometimes it works out and you get a vice president who you can imagine as president, you know, whether it's you know, Joe Biden or someone else. Sometimes it's absolutely disastrous, as was the case with Sarah Palin. But historically, this is not how the vice presidency was chosen. It's very much a modern phenomenon for the candidate and the candidate's campaign to select a running mate. Historically, the vice president was chosen by the convention. So when Abraham Lincoln decides that he wants Andrew Johnson as his vice president, Johnson was a war Democrat from a border state, but was revered in the North as the only Southern senator to stay loyal to the Union. Lincoln has to engage in massive intrigue to have a hand in Johnson becoming the running mate, because it was seen as very taboo for the front of a ticket to play any role in anointing their running mate. So Lincoln was so crafty about this that he didn't even tell his inner circle. He built a collection of people who would help him with the intrigue, who were outside of his inner circle and outside of machine politics.
Yeah, we'll continue talking about presidential ticket balancing and this idea of a marriage of convenience in a moment, but we do need to take a quick break. And coming up, more on presidents we didn't elect. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Thank you. So choosing NHPR was a rather easy decision for us.
NHPR underwriter Dan Weed of Weed Family Automotive.
I think it comes down to the roots of what you're doing and the community that you're in. So NHPR is a core part of that community. It's local, it's small business, family oriented. So I think NHPR is a great place to be.
To learn more about joining NHPR's growing family of underwriters, go to nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Today, author Jared Cohen and Accidental Presidents. What questions do you have about how vice presidents who suddenly become president govern? Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about how presidents choose their vice presidents. And Jared, you were noting that that's the campaign vetting and controlling the process is a fairly common thing. A couple of other things that jumped out at me in this regard is correct. In some cases, the vice president ended up not even being from the same party as the president.
That's correct. I mean, in the case of Andrew Johnson was a war Democrat from a border state. Lincoln was a Republican who, in 1864, they formed the National Union Party because there was a concern about uniting what was the Republican Party with a radical Republican flank that threatened to split the party. But yeah, it was a split ticket in 1864. And then you have lots of instances like in 1840 when William Henry Harrison and John Tyler run together. John Tyler is basically a Democrat who was converted to a Whig for electoral convenience. But when thinking about a running mate, historically, the vice presidency was not just about winning a state or appeasing a constituency. There weren't a lot of people who wanted the job. Yeah. So it was a combination of somebody who checks an electoral box and also wants the vice presidency. There's very few men throughout history that have actively sought it out. In fact, two of them were Millard Fillmore and Andrew Johnson, both of who became accidental presidents.
Yeah, and you mentioned Andrew Johnson, and one thing I learned in the book is that Abraham Lincoln was actually interested in another individual before Johnson, Benjamin Butler. And he is one of those individuals that would agree with you about the idea that most people don't want to be vice president. Here's what he had to say in declining Lincoln's invitation to be his vice president.
Before me was a catafalque, on which rested a corpse wrapped in funeral vest.
Ask him what he thinks I have done to deserve the punishment, at 46 years of age, of being made to sit as presiding officer over the Senate, to listen for 4 years to debates more or less stupid, in which I can take no part or say a word, nor even be allowed to vote upon any subject which concerns the welfare of the country, except when my enemies think my vote would injure me in the estimation of the people, and therefore, by some parliamentary trick, make tie on such question. So I should be compelled to vote, and then at the end of 4 years, as nowadays no vice president is ever elected president, not to be permitted to go on with my profession.
That is NHPR's Nick Capodice channeling Benjamin Butler and declining Abraham Lincoln's invitation. And Jared, I love that comment that Butler said about, you know, what did I do to deserve this?
And by the way, he's not the only man offered the vice presidency who had that kind of a reaction. It was seen as insulting. Historically, being offered the vice president was basically an invitation to be exiled to the political equivalent of Elba. That's certainly how Theodore Roosevelt felt. When the New York party bosses wanted him out and you know sort of manipulated a situation where at the 1900 Republican convention he became the only vote against his own nomination as vice president.
Mm-hmm. And a couple of other moments that in our history that I think fit into more contemporary moments that fit into this discussion of picking a vice president, as I recall, in 2008 it was rumored that John McCain, before picking Sarah Palin, was actually excited about the idea of a unity ticket with Joe Lieberman, the former Democratic vice presidential candidate. And you know, here's an example of where you would have had people from two different parties or two non-Republicans, at least. I'm not sure if Lieberman had already left the Democratic Party by then. But nonetheless, the reaction, they decided in the end that the reaction would have been severe. So just a very different time than the old days. And the other example that jumped out at me is I remember when Bill Clinton picked Al Gore. People were surprised that he would pick another similarly aged Southerner, that it was a bad move. He wasn't ticket balancing, and it ended up working for them.
So I've examined this in depth, and despite the fact that every single election, a vice president is thrown on the ticket for a tactical electoral purpose, there's no evidence historically that it accomplishes the desired goal. It's clear to me in evaluating the vice president that the right way to think about this strategically, putting aside the fact that you need somebody who can take the reins of power should a vacancy arise, but if you're thinking about it in a campaign context, you want somebody who isn't going to upstage you and isn't going to embarrass you. So where that nets out is pick somebody boring who people can imagine as president, but not more than they can imagine you as president. Mm-hmm. And given how frequently this has happened in history, that's a pretty miserable way to think about this. I mean, ideally, you know, when you look, as somebody who's a CEO, I try to hire the most talented people under me who are smarter than me, who are better than me, who could upstage me. So it's interesting looking at this through the lens of a business context. That's not how the decisions are typically made in an electoral context.
Yeah,
ticket, the other example is FDR seriously considered and with FDR, you always have to take everything with a grain of salt because he was manipulative and liked to throw things out there that confuse people. But FDR seriously considered or explored the idea of what would happen if he ran on a split ticket with Wendell Willkie. So if you look at the times in history, with the exception of the McCain, you know, Lieberman flirtation, the two serious instances where a president of the United States in one case did run with somebody from another party, in another case thought about running with somebody from another party, was during wartime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have George joining us from Freiburg. George, welcome to the Exchange.
Well, thank you very much. Actually, I have another question about the wild Willie FDR. Do you have any idea why he went through first Alvin Barkley and Henry Wallace before he finally selected Harry Truman as his final vice president?
Yes, it's a great question, George. So in The Accidental Presidents, I have a whole chapter on how Harry Truman ended up as the nominee for vice president. But by all accounts, FDR really liked Wallace a lot. He shared a lot of his views. They had a close relationship. He engaged him as vice president. When it came to 1944, FDR didn't care who he ran with as long as the person he ran with helped him win the election. He was basically a dying man. He was focused on the war. He knew he was a dying man, and it was not a question of whether or not he was going to survive. It was a question of whether he could make it through the war in time to win and maybe even see himself as the first Secretary General of the UN. So it really came down in 1944 to Jim Burns, Harry Truman, and Wallace. And in the 1944 convention, the second to last day of the convention, Wallace delivers an extraordinary speech before the convention hall. And the Wallace supporters did a sort of Trojan horse type political move where a number of them had snuck into the convention. And when the verbal vote was taken, the A's had it. So Wallace effectively was selected as the vice president, but then because it was a verbal vote, not done by written ballot, the party bosses who loathed Wallace declared a fire hazard, and they opened up the gates of they opened up the doors of the convention hall and let people storm it so that they had a justification for a fire hazard. And then the next day, they made sure that the Wallace supporters didn't come in. So what you conclude is FDR never would have allowed that to happen if he wasn't comfortable with the idea of Wallace on the ticket. But the party bosses loathed the idea that Henry Wallace would become president. And as a result, they didn't think much about whether Truman could become president, but Truman was the anti-Wallace vote.
Mm-hmm. George, thanks for that question. That was a real interesting story. Jared, let's talk a little bit generally about the early accidental presidents. You've mentioned them already, but I want to talk about a common thread that emerged to me in reading, particularly the chapters on the first three early presidents and accidental presidents, and they all seem to be dealing with that. Their presidencies were really consumed with dealing with slavery. In the context of territorial expansion, so the annexation of Texas, the Mexican War of Cessation, and bringing California, New Mexico, Utah, et cetera, into the country, this really seemed to shape the dynamic of their time in office. And again, I'm talking about Tyler, Fillmore, and Andrew Johnson.
Yeah, the first three accidental presidents, upon ascending to the presidency, marked in some respects the most dramatic shifts in the course of American history. So, you know, what you conclude by looking at John Tyler and Millard Fillmore and Andrew Johnson is the notion of somebody being a heartbeat away from the presidency really mattered at a time where the stakes were probably higher than any other moment in history. I mean, I believe that that period in the lead up to the Civil War was the most polarized chapter of American history. And John Tyler, you know, is pretty erratic in his behavior. When he gets kicked out of his own party because he doesn't subscribe to the Whig platform and vetoes the National Bank twice. And when he gets excommunicated, he tries to curry favor back with the Democrats who don't want him either because they're mad at him for running as a Whig. Mm-hmm. So in a sort of chapter of historically erratic behavior by presidents, he decides to annex Texas as his sort of only path to creating a niche for himself where he could win election right in his own right. That annexation of Texas was probably the single act that more guaranteed civil war was inevitable than anything else, because it precipitated war with Mexico, which the U.S. won, which led to the ceding of territory that was predominantly conducive to free states as opposed to slave states. So then when Millard Fillmore ascends to the presidency in 1850, America is trying to figure out what to do with this vast amount of territory and keep the nation together. Zachary Taylor, who despite being a Southern slave owner from Louisiana, was one of the biggest proponents of admitting California as a free state because he knew that those states were not conducive to slavery, and he thought it better to get on with it quickly and allow the South to save face as opposed to drawing it out for some prolonged period of time. And Taylor was the single greatest impediment to what became known as the Compromise of 1850. And when he dies, Millard Fillmore essentially reverses Taylor's policy. He sacks Zachary Taylor's entire cabinet on day one. So if we're wondering if musical chairs with cabinets is a modern phenomenon or has historical precedent, it certainly has historical precedent. And then when we look at Andrew Johnson, we should have gotten Abraham Lincoln's vision for Reconstruction, but the bullet of John Wilkes Booth gave us Andrew Johnson, who effectively resurrected elements of the Confederacy as he was putting the Union back together.
And really kind of set the groundwork for Jim Crow, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Speaking of Andrew Johnson, let's listen to Abraham Lincoln talking about a dream he had in the White House.
Before me was a catafalque on which rested a corpse wrapped in funeral vestments. Around it were stationed soldiers who were acting as guards, and there was a throng of people gazing mournfully upon the corpse whose face was covered, others weeping pitifully. "Who is dead in the White House?" I demanded of one of the soldiers. "The president," was his answer. "He was killed by an assassin."
And that is NHPR's Andrew Perella channeling Abraham Lincoln as he tells his aide, Ward Hill Lamon, that he had a dream in which he was walking around the White House and demanded to know who was killed by an assassin. It is a remarkable historical statement by Lincoln. Jared, the other interesting thread that for me in the 19th century, particularly again up through the first couple of accidental presidents, are these. Some view this as a golden age of congressional dominance, and you have these three congressional heavyweights: Henry Clay of Kentucky, John C. Calhoun of South Carolina, and our own Daniel Webster of New Hampshire and Massachusetts. And all three men are integral to your narrative, and they have their own ambitions. Sometimes they're allies, sometimes they're enemies or foils for the presidents. Could you say just a little bit about how the three of them kind of fit into this 19th century narrative?
Yes, and in writing the accidental presidents, one of the things that struck me is historically, the president has not been the dominant figure in American politics. I mean, if you think about how many great political luminaries we remember versus how many names of presidents we remember. And so in writing this book, it was the secondary characters who I most enjoyed bringing alive. And, from the time that John Tyler ascends to the presidency all the way through Millard Fillmore's ascension and the lead up to the Civil War, three of the most interesting characters are Henry Clay, Daniel Webster, and John Calhoun, the great triumvirate, as they were called. And poor Henry Clay wanted the presidency so badly, and he didn't live long enough to see a man who admired him so greatly, Abraham Lincoln, eventually ascend to the presidency and manage to win the Civil War.
Was Clay the one who kept coming back? It was either Clay or Calhoun who kept going away, and then a few years later he'd be back again.
Henry Clay, the best way to think about Henry Clay is he had elements of Michael Jordan in terms of his giganticism and retiring and coming back and retiring and coming back. He just didn't have all the rings that Michael Jordan had. So that's how I think about him. But the debates in Congress over what to do with vast amounts of territory ceded from war with Mexico, the debates between John Calhoun, who was Mr. Segregationist and Mr. Pro-Slavery, with Daniel Webster, who was a New England abolitionist, with Henry Clay, who was one of the great pragmatists of American history. The debates between the three of them, and despite the differences between the three of them, the mutual admiration / at times hatred that they had for each other, must have been a great thing to be a voyeur and watch. And Henry Clay delivered one of the great speeches of history. It was one of his last, where he talked about the five gaping wounds that were plaguing America. The five gaping wounds, of course, referring to California statehood, what to do about Utah, what to do about the Texas-New Mexico border, what to do about the slave trade in Washington, D.C., and what to do about the Fugitive Slave Act. These were the issues that defined literally multiple decades of American politics. And if we think we're polarized today, I like to remind people that it was in the midst of this polarized moment and these five gaping wounds described by Henry Clay that Senator Foote of Mississippi pulled a gun on Senator Thomas Hart Benton from Missouri and tried to shoot him right there on the Senate floor.
Yeah, it was surprising. There were a couple of episodes you describe in the book, literally of either physical violence or people pulling guns, or I mean, just remarkable by today's standards.
Yeah, despite one of the things that's interesting about writing this book, Accidental Presidents, is even though it's anchored around eight presidents who die in office, which by all accounts is sad, the book nets me out fairly optimistic because you realize the politics today maybe isn't as bad as it was historically. Brawls in Congress were a thing back then. It happened often. Burning the president in effigy on the White House lawn was a thing. When John Tyler vetoes the National Bank, angry drunken mobs throw bricks and stones through the White House glass and terrify the Tyler women so much that the government decides that maybe Washington, D.C. needs a night police.
Yeah. It was pretty remarkable that you had that one story about the revolvers on the floor of one of the chambers. It's just very, very different than today. We are coming up on another short break, but we have lots more to talk about. We're talking with Jared Cohen. He's author of a new book, Accidental Presidents, and the book is out tomorrow. It looks at the eight men who ascended to the presidency in the wake of either assassination or death of a president in office. And coming up, we'll also talk a little bit about whether we should be more deliberate in how we choose our vice presidents, or perhaps there's some other process than the way we currently choose them. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Dean Spiliotis. Tomorrow on our show, New Hampshire native and elite climber Mark Sinnott on his new book, The Impossible Climb. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, we're looking at the new book, Accidental Presidents, out tomorrow. We're talking with its author, Jared Cohn. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And The Exchange phone number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And Jared Cohn, let's shift gears and talk a little bit about the 20th century accidental presidents. As you mentioned in the book, and I found this very interesting, there are 4 of 8 accidental presidents who actually win a full term in their own right. And what struck me as particularly interesting is that all 4 of them, of the 8, are in the 20th century: Teddy Roosevelt, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, and LBJ. And I have a theory about why this is the case, but I'm interested to hear why you think that of the 4 of the 8 who won were all 20th century presidents.
So I think in writing The Accidental Presidents, I looked at this a lot to try to figure out if there were things that tied them together. And I think that the fact that the 4 accidental presidents of the 20th century, I think that that's more random than it is anything to do with the 20th century. I think Teddy Roosevelt, who was the first accidental president to win election in his own right, is the only one of the 8 who probably eventually would have been president anyway.
You don't think LBJ would have? LBJ would not have, even though he was in the Senate, he would not have ascended?
LBJ was certainly qualified to be president, but I believe he waited too long. He entered the election too late in 1960. And I don't think that it, I think that had Kennedy not been assassinated, there's a real chance about whether real question about whether Kennedy would have won again in 64. Mm-hmm. It was going to be a very tough uphill battle. And then if you look at the subsequent Republicans who were Republican elections, LBJ may have missed his window. In the case of Calvin Coolidge, Coolidge inherits the presidency very close to the 1924 election. In fact, of all the accidental presidents, he's the only one who inherits the presidency so close to when his predecessor would have been up for re-election. And even though Harding was probably the most scandalous president in our history, he died a popular man. And Coolidge's whole first year after inheriting the presidency focused on keeping the scandals quiet long enough to have it not impact the election. And in fact, the whole image of Silent Cal that he cultivated, it was based on a truth that he was kind of a quiet, Puritan who didn't leave much of a mark. But he played into it, with this idea that, a man so insignificant and quiet and boring couldn't possibly have had a hand in all of this.
Mm-hmm. And I should tell our listeners, if you like this kind of stuff, you can go over to Plymouth, Vermont, which is just a little bit past Woodstock, Vermont, and the Coolidge homestead is there, and it's now a National Historical Site, and there's a museum, and you can see the his house where I think he learned that he was going to become president. Then again, you're referring to the scandals with Harding and the Teapot Dome and the oil leases, et cetera, and his response by becoming kind of a silent Cal. It's interesting that you think that they're not related. I was curious because a lot of political scientists who talk about the institution of the presidency becoming much stronger in the 20th century, really starting with Teddy Roosevelt and the rise of the bully pulpit and the American empire with our interests starting to look outward, and the various presidential reorganizations through the Great Depression, the World Wars, and the Cold War, so that the president is kind of more visible, more central to our politics. In the 19th century, we often talk about the Whig theory of government, in which the president is a relatively weak administrative actor in comparison to Concord. So it's certainly possible that all that transformation took place, yet there's not necessarily a common thread here. I was just curious what you thought of that.
Well, it's certainly the case that the presidency got significantly stronger with Teddy Roosevelt as an inflection point.
Yep.
But
yep.
When Truman runs for election in his own right in 1948, he barely wins. I mean, so much so that the Chicago Tribune
prints the
very famous Dewey defeats Truman headline. So it certainly wasn't a given. And Truman himself thought he was going to lose.
Yeah.
And LBJ took an extraordinary gamble with the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That could have gone either way. And with its passage, he ended up creating conditions for himself to win pretty significantly in the 64 election.
Yeah, it's interesting in that your chapter on LBJ, you give him a lot of credit for moving the civil rights agenda forward, and kind of suggest that that maybe Kennedy really wasn't as central as it as some people like to think.
So my experience in researching Kennedy and LBJ for the Accidental Presidents is that I do not believe that you would have had civil rights legislation in the 1960s had Kennedy survived. And I certainly don't think you would have had it before the 1964 election. Remember, Bobby Kennedy eventually does a remarkable 180 on civil rights, but in that first Kennedy term, they're all focused on elections. And so I remember interviewing Condoleezza Rice for the book, and Jesse Jackson, and others who were part of the civil rights movement. And the narrative was that the Kennedys were prepared to pay lip service to civil rights, but they weren't prepared to take a risk. Mm-hmm. And an example that's often cited is the reaction to the bombing of the church in Birmingham, which by all accounts was not as forward-leaning as it should be. In the case of LBJ, it was a combination of two things that played out. LBJ had a terrible fear of calamity happening on his watch, and it worked to the advantage of civil rights, and it worked to the detriment of Vietnam. The difference between Vietnam and civil rights is LBJ knew how to get it done. He understood what was necessary. The catalyst for getting it done is the bombings and the Selma to Montgomery marches, and how all of this was playing out on television. LBJ believed that if he did not get this done, it would be a huge stain on his record. In the case of Vietnam, he was terrified that Vietnam was going to collapse on his watch, but he didn't have the foreign policy instincts, nor did he have the judgment to get rid of Kennedy's foreign policy advisors, who were leading him down a path towards escalation that he wasn't going to be able to walk back from.
Yeah. One of the other interesting 20th century stories that you tell in the book about Harry Truman, I was not aware of this relationship between him and Eleanor Roosevelt. I mean, you say that she's constantly offering him advice whether he wants it or not. And it seems like there was a pretty significant correspondence between the two.
Yeah, in writing The Accidental Presidents, one of my favorite things to do was to dig into the archives. And I found this incredible batch of letters between Eleanor Roosevelt and Harry Truman. And Eleanor, as First Lady, tried to opine in her husband's ear and write to her husband often, but she didn't dare infringe on foreign policy, and he wasn't really a willing listener there. What's interesting with Truman is, you know, Eleanor writes to him, you know, literally, you know, every couple days or so. There's a letter that she writes to him literally the day that he drops the bomb on Hiroshima. And she wrote to him about everything. She wrote to him about, you know, the plight of this group, of that group, of, you know, she would write to him about bureaucratic tensions and people that she didn't like. She wrote to him about, you know, the situation between, you know, Turkey and Greece. She wrote to him about Churchill. She wrote to him about, you know, the Soviet Union. And she understood that the legacy of her late husband was an asset to her. And when you read Eleanor Roosevelt's letters to Truman, in many respects, as she's channeling her late husband, it's the closest you can get to the ghost of FDR whispering mm-hmm. in the ear of Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is fascinating exchanges that you detail in the book. One other issue I want to circle back around to, you mentioned it earlier in the show, is this issue of what vice presidents, accidental presidents do with their cabinet and their key advisors. Is there any typical pattern? You mentioned some in the book that some literally fire the entire cabinet, others keep them on. Yeah, how do you sense that these accidental presidents balance taking over essentially someone else's administration?
I mean, in writing The Accidental Presidents and looking for a common thread as to who succeeded and who failed, there's really two things. One, how well they understood the context of the moment. And two, how well they curated the advisors that they inherited. So you get some like John Tyler, who was too nervous to clean out the cabinet, and he deeply regretted it. You get some like Millard Fillmore, who sacked the entire cabinet and then ends up with no department heads for multiple months. The ones that are most successful are the ones who found that balance. But also, you know, even the ones who tried to find the balance, there's a strange dynamic between the cabinet appointed by the predecessor and the accidental presidents who inherits them. Because remember, if you look at history, there's not, of all the vice presidents that inherited the presidency, none of them had a good relationship with the man who died. And the cabinet is loyal to the predecessor.
Right.
And, you know, they miss the predecessor, and then they're all pushing an agenda. So in the case of Harry Truman, the reason it worked so well is if you look at you know, the George Marshalls, the George Marshalls of the world, and the Dean Achesons of the world, these were men who really had nothing in common with, you know, Truman, who was a provincial aw shucks politician from Missouri. These were sort of Ivy League, you know, elites, but right. they were all Europeanists, and they understood that the future of the world rested on whether Harry Truman was successful. And so they made him successful. They didn't harp on the past. They didn't question his ability. There was no option other than him finding success. Whereas if you look at Lyndon Johnson, the fate of the world did not rest on Vietnam. And the you know, LBJ had nothing in common with, you know, Bob McNamara and McGeorge Bundy and others, and they led him down a very path while at the same time very difficult path while at the same time extricating themselves from the situation.
In the afterword of the book, you offer some food for thought about how we select our VPs for the campaign. I know you mentioned this a little bit earlier about how the modern process, the campaigns really control it in a way that's very different than it once was. And you also talk about the need to make sure our vice presidents are genuinely prepared. So I'm interested in your thoughts about how you might change things, or is it work pretty much the way it should at this point? You kind of speculate a little bit at the end of the book.
So I don't think candidates should be choosing the vice president or the running mate unilaterally. That's a modern phenomenon. It's not dictated by law. It's dictated by party norms and party rules. And, you know, what it does is it biases towards electoral math of that particular week or that particular month. Instead, I think that my view is, you know, if I were a party chair, I would try to change the rules and the norms and say that the only people eligible to be thrown on the ticket are people who were running for president in the first place, so we can see, you know, how they do campaigning for the job and essentially interviewing with the voters for the job. And then, you know, I think that you could imagine a situation where, much like the superdelegate phenomenon, you could have certain number of delegates who are anointed with extra authority to be part of the vice presidential selection process. But I think that to choose somebody who might one day end up leading the country, depending on what the polling numbers look like on that particular week, doesn't seem to me to be a very responsible way to go about doing this, particularly when it's happened 8 times in our history.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting to me. It made me think of this recent discussion that the analysts in the media have been having about Joe Biden, and they, at some point, the campaign floated a trial balloon of perhaps having the former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams join him on the ticket in advance. And I've never been a big fan of these kinds of advanced ticket types of deals. I don't know how effective they are, but, you know, she's certainly maybe qualified to be vice president. But the idea of trying to announce a ticket in advance, and it was not all that well received. And my thought was what you just mentioned. Why not wait and see how everybody performs over time? If you're going to have 20 some odd people running for president, you can get a good look at them in advance.
Exactly. And it's also if the party has more control over who runs with the person on the front of the ticket, then the party has some degree of ability to hold the candidate accountable. But when a presidential nominee gets to choose their own running mate, at that point, the party, unless they want to lose the election, has really no recourse to hold the candidate accountable. So, you know, we talk about balancing the ticket for the general electorate. I think it's important to balance the ticket in a way that gives a nod to elements of the party that aren't necessarily reflected on the front of the ticket. And then historically, that is how it was done. If you look at, you know, Chester Arthur being thrown on the ticket with James Garfield, you know, he was a stalwart part of the machine, you know, machine politics, and Garfield wouldn't have been able to keep the party together had Arthur not been his running mate.
Yeah, well, it just seems that, you know, campaigns, the nominee's campaign seems to have such strong control over the convention in this point. I'm not sure how you would even go about, I mean, how would you even go about changing that? Who would initiate that? Would be the party?
Well, I think if the party would have to initiate it, but it's not a law. It's a party rule. It's a party norm.
You may have mentioned this already, but when did that start really? When did the transition happen?
I mean, it really is a sort of 1960s and beyond phenomenon. It's not. Okay. This is not a deep part of our history. It's not
recent.
As abrupt. But it's. This is not how we've historically done it. And I think that the Democrats have an opportunity in this particular election to do this, just because you have so many people running for the first spot on the ticket. And I have to assume, by the way, that a number of them are also, you know, in this because they think they might be selected as vice president. So the likelihood of the Democratic ticket, including as a vice presidential nominee, somebody who right now is running for president, if that happens, it might be a good idea for somebody to say this is how we should do it going forward.
So just real quick, what's your general sense of these kinds of, I mean, I hesitate to call them stunts, but strategies where, you know, you always hear talk about, oh, you know, candidate X should say candidate Y is going to be my VP up front and I'll only do one term, you know, those kinds of trying to game the system in advance.
It rarely works out.
Yeah.
The assumptions have been the same in modern times, and they've not proven grounded in reality. Yeah. And we keep making the same mistake over and over again. And I think it's up to the voters to demand a way of doing this other than what has become the conventional norm, because it's grossly irresponsible.
Yeah, lots to think about. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank Jared Cohn for an informative and enjoyable conversation this morning. Yeah, who knew that vice presidents could be so interested? Jared, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
That is Jared Cohn. He's author of the new book, Accidental Presidents, 8 Men Who Changed America. It's out tomorrow. He is the founder and CEO of Jigsaw, a technology incubator and subsidiary of Alphabet Inc., the parent company of Google. He's also an adjunct senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations, and he joined us from New York City. And remember, the conversation always continues online, on Facebook, on Twitter, and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.